We're going to talk about the eugenics scare. We're going to look at some extremely interesting history of the past 100 years or so. I think history in this area is especially rich. I will probably be ringing some familiar bells for you. I will be reading actually little portions from materials that were prepared that you may have had back in your Psych 1 days, or may have read about the Kallikaks and the Juke study. Remember that stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you'll get a little different insight on it now. You may even learn that some of the things you learned weren't exactly accurate. I have two purposes I want to try and convey this morning. One is that most persons who are retarded do not come from parents who are retarded. That'll be one thing you'll learn, I hope. The second thing is that the gene pool, G-E-N-E, the gene pool from which we were all drawn and from which most of us will contribute in some way, is not becoming, as the scaremongers have tried to imply or coach, is not becoming inadequate. And I will be presenting a little bit of data about that. Now, where lifeboat ethics fits into this goes something like this. The other day, Jim Burtons and I split a session where we each took a piece of it, and Jim talked about the lifeboat ethics phenomenon. I don't remember the author's name anymore. Maybe some of you do.
Hardy.
Okay. After that presentation, I showed a film which simulated an actual event at Johns Hopkins Hospital where a Down syndrome child, a mongoloid child, who had an intestinal obstruction which could have been operated on quite easily, was allowed to starve to death. Now, Jim and I tried to take lifeboat ethics and sort of have them bridge that situation. Lifeboat ethics, in essence, without going into it very deeply, I don't profess to know it very well, essentially means that society has to make or might make decisions about itself, about who is going to be allowed to be in the lifeboat and who is going to be thrown out or denied access. Where the mentally retarded fit in, as I tried to indicate, is that they are the most easily put out. They are the ones who can be pushed out of the lifeboat most easily. They don't have the physical ability to fight for entry to the lifeboat, nor do they have the mental capacity to be clever enough to get in some other way. What we're going to talk about today to fit into the lifeboat ethics or the lifeboat analogy sort of thing is a little more remote, and I have to confess that I have to stretch it a bit, but nevertheless I'm going to do that. Let's suppose that the ship carrying the lifeboats has a large amount of food on board and yet can never enter a port. Okay? For many generations. Now, of course, that's impossible, but let's talk about it anyway. The people on the boat would be vastly restricted in who they would choose as mates. Not first mates, you know, but mates, real mates, husband, wife. The gene pool, in other words, would be restricted to the boat, to the ship. The effect of that over generations would be that brothers would marry sisters, cousins would marry cousins, and so forth. The gene pool would gradually become more restricted. The randomness that occurred when everybody got on board originally would have been reduced. There would be less randomness. There would be more unrandomness. The gene pool would have become restricted, in this case because of geography. And here's what would happen. I'm going to give you just enough genetics to be dangerous, because that's about as much as I know, just enough to be dangerous. What I've tried to show here is what happens when a gene pool is restricted. In this case that I've given you by geography. There are other ways that it can be restricted, which we aren't going to talk about. The recessive characteristics, such as crossed eyes, for example, let's take that one. In an unrestricted gene pool, since by definition, recessive characteristics occur by pairing, the female and the male contributing their equal shares to it, then in a fully random gene pool, where people have extreme mobility, where they can marry from any ship, getting back to the lifeboat ethics kind of thing, there will be little chance that chromosome material, that recessive characteristics, will be paired, that genetic characteristics will be paired. I haven't tried to portray these things as being chromosomes or genetic bands or anything like that. They're just a figure that's convenient for showing how this works. In other words, these things do not match up. And in most random pairings, that's the way it would be. Many of the recessive characteristics that you and I carry, and it's estimated that all of us carry some, almost all of us, 99.5% of us carry some deleterious recessive characteristics, those usually don't get expressed because they don't match up, because we mate randomly. We're not restricted. We may marry outside of our own country, outside of our own race, outside of our own culture, outside of our own ethnic group. Obviously, there are reasons not to do that in terms of Christian belief, but the full possibility of mating outside of the immediate gene pool is there. For us who have the advantage of marrying without restriction. On the other hand, if you restrict the gene pool as we did on that ship where people intermarried cousins and sisters and brothers for several generations, you would then begin to get recessive characteristics because of that intermarriage. There would be more matching up, as has happened here, where these two recessive characteristics are matched, and that recessive characteristic would then be expressed. That's why back in the 1920s, when people discovered persons who had been cut off in mountain hollows, let's say in Tennessee for many generations, people who examined them found that through intermarriage, some of these recessive characteristics were expressed very, very often. I have a picture back in my office of a group of children in one of these isolated mountain hollows, and I think there are about 12 children, and they all have crossed eyes. And that would be very, very unlikely to occur in a situation where a gene pool would be completely open for persons to marry whomever they want to. Obviously, gene pools can be restricted by other means other than geographic considerations. Racial characteristics also restrict the gene pool. If you ghettoize people, you restrict their gene pool. Okay, if we can leave this small discussion on some of the minor technicalities of genetics, let me get you into some of the rich history, and then we'll wind up with a current update on what's happening in the gene pool worldwide, according to some experts, and what are some of the things we can do to keep the gene pool intact without unnecessarily tinkering with it. Because as you know, and I know, increasingly, as we mess with Mother Nature, or Father Nature, we've got to be careful because Carol give an extra shot to women, we got to make sure that they don't get an advantage on it. Every time we fool around, we seem to screw things up. We mess around by closing up the salt marshes, and we find out we're messing up the balance of life. We cut down forests. We know what happens. Every time we seem to do something in the name of progress, we seem to mess it up. There are many people who say, mess around with the gene pool. Begin to restrict who can marry whom, and you may be in for very, very big problems. And in a little while, I'll give you a short explanation of why one of these experts thinks that. Okay, let's go back into the genetic scare era, about 100 years ago. And I'm going to read this because I can't paraphrase it as richly, nearly as richly as these authors can. And it'll also go a little faster because I want to make sure I give you kind of a feeling of closure before you leave. In the early days of active interest in mental deficiency, there were occasional references to heredity as a cause. These were offered unemotionally as assumptions, as the results of general observations not based on statistical data. The main emphasis centered around the retarded individuals themselves. May I point out that the examination of chromosome material and the whole era that we're in now of genetic counseling was not available to these people 100 years ago. It wasn't until 1959, in fact, that we could actually look at human chromosomes and count them. If you are as old as I am, you were probably taught that the human has 48 chromosomes, because that's what people thought. Then in 1959, the technology became available to count chromosomes, and we found out that we had 46. Normal person has 46. So these people didn't have that kind of data. And so this is why the history is so interesting. They ran off on some tracks that they shouldn't have. In 1865, Sir Francis Galton expressed in rather sweeping terms his concern about the destiny of the human race. Unchecked fertility of the unfit was presented as a threat to be averted by programs calculated to reduce their birth rate. In 1883, Galton introduced the concept of eugenics, a term coined by him as, quote, the science which deals with all the influences that improve the inborn qualities of a race, end quote. A few years previously, in July of 1874, Dugdale, a penologist, one who dealt with penal institutions of prisons, had been deputized or commissioned by the Prison Association of New York to visit county jails and state prisons and to report about them. He found six persons under different family names who turned out to be blood relations in some degree. These six persons belonged to a long lineage reaching back to the early colonists who had lived in the same locality for generations and were so despised by the reputable community that their family name had come to be used generically as a term of reproach. Dugdale made a genealogical survey which was published in 1877 under the title, and here it comes because you've probably seen it or heard about it, The Jukes, a study in crime, pauperism, disease, and heredity. Wow, what a title. That one would make a pretty good title for a movie these days. The family descended from the two sons of a backwoodsman called Max, who married two of the five Jukes sisters. Jukes is a fictitious name. Information was obtained about 709 out of 1,200 descendants. Of these, 140 had been in prison for crime. 280 were paupers, dependent on public support, and the majority were of low physical and moral standards. Elisha Harris, M.D., corresponding secretary of the Prison Association, wrote an introduction to the book. In it, he called attention to the, quote, social Hades of the dangerous classes, end quote. If some of this begins to turn out to be what's known in French as déjà vu, you begin to say, somewhere I've heard some of that kind of stuff. Again, if you've been around as long as I have, you heard it during the 1930s, the 1940s, when Hitler was coming into power, when he was talking about the dangerous classes, namely the Jews, and also the retarded. Dugdale himself made no special reference to mental deficiency. His book was reprinted in 1910. Now I think I'm going to skip a little bit about this. 14 years after the first publication of Dugdale's book, the Reverend O.C. McCulloch presented at the 15th annual session of the National Conference of Charities and Correction held in Buffalo the story of the tribe of Ishmael. This will be kind of interesting to those of you who have read the Bible, which includes all of us, I presume. He acknowledged that his report, quote, resembles the study of Dr. Dugdale into the Jukes and was suggested by that, end quote. This was a family with a pauper history of several generations and so intermarried with others as to form a pauper ganglion of several hundred. McCulloch referred to them as a decaying stock and a festering mass. There was no special allusion to mental deficiency, but this seemed to be implied. What can we do? The Reverend asked. And his answer was, first, we must close up official outdoor relief. Interesting solution. Second, we must check private and indiscriminate benevolence, falsely so called. And third, we must get hold of the children, end quote. In 1905, the Swiss psychologist Jorger, rounded up a family of vagrants whom he called zeros. Isn't that an awful, you know? The terms we use are so derogatory and indicate our feelings before all the data are in. The zeros, according to Jorger, were a sample of hereditary transmission. In 1919, he gave a similar account of the family Marcus, one of whose female ancestors had been married to one of the zero ancestors. In both family groups, there were said to be about 20% imbeciles. In 1911, Charles B. Davenport declared categorically, quote, two mentally defective parents will produce only mentally defective offspring, end quote. This is the first law of inheritance of mental ability. The second law of heredity of mentality is that, aside from Down syndrome persons, probably no imbecile is born except of parents who, if not mentally defective themselves, both carry mental defect in their germplasm. In view of the certainty that all of the children of two feeble-minded parents will be defective, how great is the folly, yes, the crime of letting two such persons marry, exclamation mark, end quote. Okay. Obviously, he was scaring a lot of people. And now in 1912, along came a person by the name of Goddard, who was the first superintendent of Vineland State Hospital, or training school, a very large and prominent institution in its day. And Goddard now jumps on the eugenics scare bandwagon, not because he was a bad person, but because he was misinformed, and he comes out with a study of the Kallikaks. Now you remember, if you have had exposure to that, the Kallikaks and the Jukes were kind of presented together, and now here's the Kallikak study, which is kind of an interesting one. In 1912, Goddard brought notoriety to a family known by the fictitious name Kallikak. The story of the Kallikaks kindled a spark which soon burst into flames and drove a number of volunteer firefighters to frantic activity. And here's the way that story goes, and I quote. One bright October day, there came to the training school at Vineland a little 8-year-old girl. She had been born in an almshouse. A field worker was assigned to trace Deborah's ancestral background. The great-great-great-grandfather, Martin, joined a military company at the beginning of the Revolution. In a tavern, he met a feeble-minded girl by whom he became the father of a feeble-minded son, Martin Kallikak, Jr. From him have come 480 descendants. 143 of these, we have conclusive proof, were or are feeble-minded, while only 46 have been found normal. The rest are unknown or doubtful. Among these 480 descendants, 36 have been illegitimate. There have been 33 sexually immoral persons, mostly prostitutes. There have been 24 confirmed alcoholics, blah, 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 blah. I won't read the whole family tree here. Now, on The same Martin Kallikak, on leaving the Revolutionary Army, straightened up and married a respectable girl of good family. And through this union has come another line of descendants of radically different character. These now number 496 in direct descent. All of the legitimate children of Martin Sr. married into the best families in their state. The descendants of colonial governors, signers of the Declaration of Independence, soldiers, as if all soldiers are now, and even the founders of a great university. Indeed, in this family and its collateral branches, we find nothing but good representative citizenship. There are doctors, lawyers, judges, educators, traders, landholders, in short, respectable citizens, men and women prominent in every face of social life, end quote. The name Kallikak, invented by Goddard, stems from a combination of two Greek words, kalos, meaning attractive and pleasing, and kakos, meaning bad or evil. Thus the name was to symbolize the two lines of the descendants of Martin Sr., one respectable, intelligent, well-adjusted, and the other worthless, a blot on society. Goddard concluded from his study, quote, feeble-mindedness is hereditary and transmitted as surely as any other character. We cannot successfully cope with these conditions until we recognize feeble-mindedness and its hereditary nature, recognize it early, and take care of it. In considering the question of care, segregation through colonization seems in the present state of our knowledge to be the ideal and perfectly satisfactory method, end quote. By the way, during this same period of time, as I pointed out the other night in a forum, institutions were being built at a frantic pace, very large institutions, because of the idea that mentally retarded people ought to be shut away so that they couldn't reproduce, to protect them from themselves and to protect society from them. And that's why almost every state in this country has large institutions, large big buildings, many of which are built out in the fringe areas of the cities, so that they're as far away, kind of out of sight, out of mind, as is possible. All right, just a few words about some of the so-called evidence that Goddard presented. How conclusive was the repeatedly emphasized evidence of feeble-mindedness of individuals not personally known to the field worker? Remember now, Goddard was looking back on the family tree of many individuals who had died, who he couldn't personally interview. A reader with some degree of skepticism has a right to be rather puzzled by the assertion, quote, after some experience, the field worker becomes expert in inferring the condition of those persons who are not seen from the similarity of the language used in describing them to that used in describing persons whom she has seen, end quote. Today, if we tried to publish research like that, we would be defrocked. In my racket, we wouldn't call it defrocking. I don't know if we would call it. And while it is stated in the preface that, quote, the data here presented are, we believe, accurate to a high degree, end quote, the very next sentence in Goddard's report reads as follows, quote, it is true that we have made rather dogmatic statements and have drawn conclusions that do not seem scientifically warranted from the data, end quote. Well, I won't go on anymore. Following his study, there were others who jumped on the bandwagon, and so we had studies that were called the Nams and Hill Folk Study, the study of the family of Sam 60. Isn't that terrible? Sam 60. Now, can you imagine why Sam 60, why the name Sam 60 was applied here? Yeah, because he supposedly had an IQ of 60 as measured by the Arthur Point Scale. All right, I want to end this little historical sketch with one final paragraph. The eugenicists gave much thought to means of reducing the number of the mentally retarded. A committee of the American Breeders Association, convening in 1911, reviewed 10 possible reactions to the existing problem, with a view of purging from the blood of the race the innately defective strains, end quote. And the list goes like this, and there are 10 suggestions. First of all, laissez-faire. This reaction was, of course, the perpetuation of an age-old attitude which had existed in the pre-eugenic past. It had its strongest supporters in certain theological quarters. Second solution, euthanasia. Even the most frightened people shied away from an off-with-their-heads program. Third solution, restrictive marriage laws and customs. Fourth, genetic education. This was not an altogether new idea. Disselhoff mentioned in an 18th century edict by the Archbishop of Würzburg, which admonished the inhabitants of Gerolzhofen to marry persons from other towns in order to put an end to endemic cretinism in their own community. Fifth solution, systems of matings purporting to remove defective traits. Sixth, scientific breeding. Seventh, birth control. Eighth, general environmental improvement. Nine, institutionalization or colonization. Tenth, sterilization. It is worthy of note that the list made no reference to medical or any other kind of research. The overriding thought was, we have decided that the mental have-nots in our midst will, because they are maintained by private and official philanthropy, thrive and multiply and render helpless the dwindling remainder of the intellectual haves. We must get them out of circulation and curtail their propagation. Hence, of the 10 points on the list, segregation and sterilization seem to the committee to promise the best and earliest results. Segregation for life, or at least during the reproductive years, must, in the opinion of the committee, be the principal agent used by society in cutting off its supply of defectives. Sterilization was also advocated, and so you had, in every state in the Union, at least every one that I know of, the building of large institutions which were called colonies. The one I worked at was called Northern Colony, Northern Wisconsin Colony and Training School. Colonies. Colonies set up for mentally defective people so they would be taken out of circulation. And sterilization, which occurred in some states at a rather frantic pace, where people were sterilized without consent, without even informed consent from their parents, and especially this sterilization was practiced when people were to be released to the community. They wanted them not to go out in a way that they could reproduce. Okay, let's skip from here and let me bring you up to date, and then we'll quit so that you can ask questions. This was the scare back 100 years ago. Obviously, not all of it is untrue. A lot of it came about as a result of ignorance, but it's not all ignorance. There is some merit to it. Let's see what a current overview of the gene pool and the risks of having retarded people around in terms of sullying that gene pool look like. I'm going to read a very short summary, that long, from a rather lengthy article by two of the most prominent geneticists in the country. Reed and Anderson, Sheldon Reed and Elvin Anderson. They did a rather extensive study of the family history of a number of retarded persons who had been institutionalized. And this is what their summary reads like, and I think it helps make some very important points. Our studies have demonstrated that there is approximately a zero correlation between measured intelligence and family size when the childless persons in the parental generation are included in the data. Okay, a common misunderstanding among the public at large is that most families that have retarded people in them are very large, and some are, but many are not, and many retarded persons never marry, and many retarded persons never reproduce, and of course many retarded people expire earlier, die earlier than the normal because of other genetic defects that accompany the mental retardation, and so they never have a chance to reproduce. Summary point number two. Some retarded persons have very large families, but more than half of them do not have any children at all. As a result, the average number of children per individual produced by the retarded segment of the population is a little smaller than the average produced by the non-retarded. Third, it is possible to construct genetic models to demonstrate what could be expected if more retarded persons were reproducing. Our model shows that at present, retarded parents produce about 17% of all retarded children. Let me read that again. Our model shows that at present, retarded parents produce about 17% of all retarded children. It means that 83% of retarded children come from normal parents. Consequently, if no retarded persons had any offspring, there would be a 17% decrease in the proportion of mentally retarded persons in the next generation. Of course, in subsequent generations, those things would bounce back again because of the natural laws of genetics. Another fourth point. Another model shows what would happen if all retardates reproduced at the same rate as their normal siblings, an assumption unlikely to be realized, for many retardates do not survive to reproductive age. However, if this rate of reproduction were possible for the retarded, the proportion of the retarded children produced by retarded parents would increase from 17 to 26%. Still, that only accounts for about a quarter of all those who are retarded. Okay, now, I'm going to finish up with a very interestingly written overall overview of what's happening to the gene pool. People who have speculated, and this also comes back very nicely into the lifeboat ethics kind of thing, because it talks about survival of the fittest and so forth. People who have speculated about the earthly fate of man have been divided between the optimists, who believe that we progress quickly, and the pessimists, who believe we have reached our peak and there is no future but decay. But optimism and pessimism are attitudes. Chemists do not rejoice in the fact that the atomic weight of carbon is 12. Mathematicians do not regard it as a scandal that pi cannot be expressed as the quotient of two integers. Optimism and pessimism are hardly matters for scientists whose business is truth. It seems to me we should be concerned with attitude. We should not be concerned with attitude, but with perspective, theory, and facts. The first order of business is to decide what our hopes might be for the future of the race. Doubtless, we would wish to achieve two objectives, survival and excellence. Obviously, you can't have excellence before you have survival. Of these, survival is a question of hard, objective fact, to which at some time in the future, there will be a definite answer. Excellence now, and perhaps permanently, involves value judgments which are incurably personal. From one viewpoint, the objectives are the same. What conduces to survival is excellence, and to pursue the one is to pursue the other. Such are value judgments, however, that there may be some conflict between the two objectives, and this conflict must be resolved if any coherent policy is to result. For if we believe that one crowded hour of glorious life is worth an age without a name, then it is clear enough we should cultivate only the excellent. There might, however, be fierce dispute as to who are excellent. The judges are part of the judge, and we have reasons, mathematical, philosophical, and psychological, for believing that a system for deciding cannot be constructed entirely from inside that system. Thus, the ultimate practical criterion of excellence would perhaps be reduced to identification of people who succeed in killing off the rest, a criterion which would again imply that excellence is the capacity to survive. A more successful approach to the future would seem to be the one that optimizes the chance of survival for the species. Since history seems to suggest that the ill-equipped do not survive, such a policy would guarantee some kind of excellence, though to the visionary and the poet it might be somewhat drab. At least in a sense, the reference point would be something outside the system. While to find a common denominator we might have to settle for rather materialistic standards, there would at least be a firm criterion of excellence to which we might appeal. This point of view is open to the old criticism that survival of the fittest really means survival of the survivor. Furthermore, to argue the security of the future from the events of the past is to take a somewhat precarious position, since survival might not have been achieved through effective mechanisms, but might only be the realization of a very unlikely event. Had the scheme failed, we would not be here to discuss it. Thus, we cannot really project with certainty the future of the race. The whole system might break down at the next challenge. Nevertheless, we must pay some attention to the mechanisms that have maintained an unbroken thread of life for perhaps 2 billion years. To discard them out of pessimism after a few hasty speculations seems to put the best face on it, a trifle arrogant. The firmest fact known about the dynamics of genetic mechanisms is that they are conservative. An organism, as it grows, acquires all manner of insights, techniques, and useful habits. Nevertheless, in the offspring, all this acquired wisdom is erased. The offspring's endowment at birth is little different from that of his parents at their birth. The discrepancy between the quality of the adult at the height of his powers and the quality of the newborn is slight in insects and seems to increase steadily with ascent in the evolutionary scale. Many years ago, the psychologist William McDougall, who was the formulator of most of our ideas about instinct, suggested that it is precisely because so little of human behavior is programmed through instinct that, while the young child is so helpless, the adult has such freedom of decision and such flexibility in adapting to strange circumstances. Thus, what at first sight may look like a very clumsy mechanism may in fact be essential to the fullness of humanity. The lesson from McDougall's observation seems to be that pursuing objectives implies accepting the means to these objectives. Superficial judgments about what in the human genome is desirable and what is not may lead to confident but nonetheless disastrous policies. It is desirable that babies should be far from perfect human beings because their very incompleteness allows the development of a more subtle and adaptable final product. It is desirable that a gene pool be far from perfect because its variability makes possible a more subtle and adaptable species. The force of the former argument is easy to see, but the latter may be just as important. We do not perform drastic operations on babies because of the behavior of their bowels. Perhaps we should beware of tampering with the genetic structure of populations until we are all satisfied that we know what the consequences may be. Today, and I'm almost finished now, today geneticists are convinced that because of the profound conservatism of the reproductive process, the gene pool has long been in a state of near equilibrium, perturbed only by an imperceptibly slow trend toward improvement of the genetic stock. Of course, the eugenicists in the early days may have believed that the majority of mankind was free of genetic taint. Now we believe differently. A very conservative estimate would be that 95% of all people carry harmful genes. A more reasonable estimate would be more like 99.9%. The majority of these genes, of course, are genes for recessive traits and for the most part difficult to detect. Thus, if the human race is to reproduce from unsullied stock only, a minute fraction of the population is going to be very busy indeed. Okay, one last paragraph and then I'll quit and throw it open to you. There are various methods by which we may regulate the distribution of payments for disorders stemming from a single locus on a chromosome. We can forbid or discourage marriages between brothers and sisters and cousins and so forth, which of course we have done. We can limit families, which of course we haven't done yet, by selective abortion, which is legally possible now, and by the early diagnosis and efficient treatment of cases. Almost any of these strategies will take the load off the few and distribute it among the many, with little, if any, change in the total burden, and without giving rise to an uncontainable increase in the dimension of the problem. To err on the side of compassion is not only compassionate, but also not much in error. Okay, I'll throw it open to you now.
When I read from that last part there that you're saying that you have a family that when you have several white children, you have one who's retarded, that this is because in any one of us this could happen. At least 95-99% of the people have this kind of gene dimension.
Yes. Most of the very defective children, most of the severely and profoundly retarded, come from normal parents.
Well, then what factor does age determine mental retardation?
In some,
it's oftentimes been said, you know, that women over 50 should not conceive.
In some types of mental retardation, particularly Down syndrome or Mongolism, the probabilities of having a Down syndrome child increase rather dramatically with age in the mother. A mother in the prime childbearing years, namely somewhere in the early 20s, would have a chance of maybe 1 in 30 of having a Down, I'm sorry, 1 in 1,000 of having a Down syndrome child. By the time she's 45, the chances would be about 1 in 30. Now, so we know that kind of mental retardation is associated with advanced maternal age. Other kinds of mental retardation have a slight correlation with maternal age, simply because the whole reproductive system of the mother at 45 is less flexible, less robust than would be true in the early childbearing years. But as we all know too, it's not at all uncommon for a 45-year-old mother to have a perfectly normal or bright child. The chances still of having a retarded child are less than of having a perfectly normal child.
The age of the child or
It appears not, but lest we give too much fuel to the male chauvinist, until recently, we thought that Down syndrome, the condition of Mongolism, was always associated with a chromosome defect in the maternal chromosome material. And now we know that the father can contribute that material also. So women have not been castigated as being the only cause in this condition. The man can carry it too. Yes. The author from whom I just read would say from the genetic pool standpoint that no one should ever be restricted from bearing children. From a more humanistic and a more Christian point of view, my own view would be that in a compassionate society, persons who cannot cope with children should not have them. Sure, I recognize that it's that for normal children, adoption these days is very easy, but that's not true of mentally retarded children. Mentally retarded children frequently grow up in foster homes or institutions because no one will adopt them. So my own view would be that with the consent, as much as possible, of the parents of the child, that counseling be provided, and that somebody may have to take some pretty drastic action. If you make a decision to err on the side of compassion in an individual case, or in many individual cases, you will not affect the gene pool that much. Natural mutations will still occur. Other decisions will not be made for one reason or another, and so you aren't going to really foul up that gene pool very much. In my own opinion, making a decision on the basis of compassion is the right thing to do. It isn't going to affect the gene pool that much. I'd be happy to talk with you individually more about the particulars in this case you're talking about, though. Yes?
I did not want to leave. I was subject when I was pregnant. Mainly because of the fear that you have of Indian about what your child, your Indian, is going to be turning out like.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of reading that, it seems that there's an awful lot of leaning towards the other reasons now for why these things occur. You know, like especially with Down syndrome, like I ran into a lot of things that were saying that there's a lot of environmental factors that are coming out now as to why a child turns out like he does. In other words, I just wonder how much, this, are you saying here now, I'm trying to figure out, are we talking about the fact that still there is genetic reason for these things to occur? Whereas in my reading, they were saying pretty well that it wasn't genetic, it was environmental factors.
Down syndrome as a chromosome abnormality is a genetic fact. What happens to the child, what would happen to a number of children who would all have this genetic fact of Down syndrome would vary a great deal depending on their environment and also depending on the other genetic material that they carried with them.
Well, just like there was one book that said that there was some studies in communities where there was an extreme amount of fluoride in the water, and they said that there was a higher degree of Down syndrome occurring in this area where there was fluoride in the water.
That's erroneous. There are a few things that I'm rather expert in. One is it Down syndrome, because we've had a study with Down syndrome babies for 5 years, and I've had a lot of time to read.
Yeah.
When
you don't know what to believe, when you read all these things, you get scared and clean, you can't drink anything with fluoride and water, and you've got to take an awful lot of vitamin D complex because that creates bright children. This is the kind of thing I was reading.
Well, I'm just trying to set that straight.
Yeah.
In terms of Down syndrome, there is no chemical, toxic, any kind of factor, except maternal age, obviously, that I just mentioned, that is associated with the production of a Down syndrome child. There have been many things proposed. Too much fluoride, which has now been refuted. A history of hepatitis in the family. That was once thought to be a causative factor. Vitamin deficiencies, chemical deficiencies. All of them have been tracked pretty carefully and studied very carefully. The research goes on at a frantic pace in that field because it's likely that there is some causative factor we don't know about that causes the chromosome abnormality in the first place. And if we can discover that, then we will have solved the riddle and we won't produce Down syndrome children anymore. But as of now, I can tell you there is no agent except maternal aging that is highly correlated with the production of a Down syndrome child.
Isn't rubella one of the greatest causes of retardation?
Right, rubella is a cause, especially, it's not as great a cause as we once thought, but its risk factor is greatest during the first trimester. Mother contracting rubella in the first trimester, the chances of having a retarded child were once thought to be very great. Now they'd be about, somewhat under 25%, even in the first trimester. And of course, rubella now, you can get a shot for that, so you don't have to have rubella during pregnancy. So that one is pretty well solved too. Yeah.
Might be useful, although I don't think it's in the whole area, but it's possible to identify a Down syndrome fetus probably in mid-pregnancy by tapping the amniotic sac and examining the chromosomes of the cells of the cage. Perhaps if there's compassion to be exerted on the behalf of a mother, let's say, who's not really, or a family complex that couldn't handle that, there's something to be considered there, since we would know that before birth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's 4.5 months, isn't it?
No.
I don't really know the time at which you could determine that, but it basically boils down to a time when it's practical or safe to enter the amniotic sac with a needle. It's not, you could determine that much earlier if you didn't care about the state of that fetus, but I suspect it's pretty close to that point.
About 12 weeks, about 3 months, the fetus is beginning to shed enough cells through the urinary process and so forth, so that by taking a sample of the amniotic fluid and then subjecting it to cell reproduction and then arresting development of the cell, killing the cell actually at the point where it's dividing, you can look at the chromosomes and tell for sure whether the mother is carrying a Down syndrome child or other kinds of chromosome abnormalities. And then depending on what the parents' religious beliefs are and their own proclivities, therapeutic abortion could be in order, depending on what they feel. It is a sure way of detecting the fact that there is a retarded child there, a Down syndrome child there.
The other announcement is the coffee and tea back in the room.
Okay. One more question, and then I think we better quit. Yes?
I don't have a question, and I'm not scientifically minded at all. Let's see, how shall I say this? In our relationship, in our family, on both sides, on my husband, on my family's side, on my husband's side, there are two retarded children. And especially in the one case, within this entire family environment, the brightest spot in the whole situation, which is quite involved, is the 30-year-old retarded fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm only saying that because he's the greatest joy of the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not scientific, but I mean, I would... there is so much that he has taught the entire family. All I'm saying is that so he is retarded to a degree. His mother had measles. I would dread to think that we didn't know him in our family relationship. I just want to say that much.
I'm glad you have. Obviously, I've been trying
to... Right.
I try not to put out my own thoughts too clearly, too openly, and because I think that's a little unfair in a session like this. But I think it's only fair to add that I'm certainly against euthanasia. If you were around on Thursday, I'll be showing a film that portrays euthanasia. I'm not against therapeutic abortions in some cases.
And I'm realizing that this is not an extreme case in any way, but he is in that classification to a degree, deafness and some mentality, and the other also. And so I'm agreeing with that, but it would have been a pity if that life had been snuffed out at the first third or in the very beginning, because he's been such a joy to all of us. But I know that there would be cases where that maybe not be true. So it would become very difficult.
You bet it is. All of these considerations obviously are soul searching, not without ambiguity, not without risk. Lee?
It's interesting, but Abraham Lincoln had a very strong genetic defect, which it isn't worth really discussing, but he did. It is entirely desirable. His physical makeup, his face, and his body form were very difficult. And while it isn't really proven in a genetic sense, most medical people would agree. And, you know, what was the lack of the loss of that person? It's really
tragic.
Too bad we have a word like retarded.
Right.
We're just other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I agree with that, because this, it's a pity to say this boy has that title, because in his he may be deficient in one area, but he far surpasses it in compassion and the love of nature, compassion for all people, and great joy within the spirit. That's why it's difficult for me to think of him with that word,
mm-hmm.
because he is probably, he could be genius in another area.
Another comment there, I don't know much about this than you do, but there are people called idiots for man who have extraordinary talents in mathematics and music that are just superhuman, and yet they may be otherwise rather peculiar apparently people. Who's to say what that kind of
thing? This is my question.
Yeah.
I mean, who are we to say?
In other words, there's a big there should be a big difference in your head between somebody we call retarded and somebody we call dumb. Lots of the most educated people are pretty dumb, aren't they? In fact, I'm giving away the kind of title of my Vesper talk on Wednesday. I'm going to try and contrast. In fact, I'm going to entitle it Dumbbell Mountain. It's kind of nice that it's out there so that we can talk about it. I think we better quit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.